Hey, cashiers. We Have the Receipts podcast is coming at you live from Netflix is a Joke Fest in Los Angeles.
Chris, are you kidding?
No, Netflix is a joke, Courtney, but this is not one of them. Our listeners in LA have the chance to join us for a live recording of our podcast, We Have the Receipts, hosted by me, Chris Burns.
And me, Courtney Revolution.
Join us and a few surprise guests from your favorite Netflix reality shows on Saturday, May 4th at 1 p.m. at a secret location in Hollywood.
To be announced.
Get your tickets for the We Have the Receipts live show at tudum.com/WHTR. That's Tudum, TUDUM.com/WHTR.
Tickets are limited. If you can't make it to the show, we still want to hear your beautiful voice. Leave us a message at speakpipe.com/WeHaveTheReceipts.
You may even hear your own voice on the show.
Grab a ticket at tudum.com/WHTR.
And we'll see you on May 4th in Los Angeles. Bye, cashiers.
Welcome to Present Company, the Netflix podcast that brings you dynamic conversations with exceptional people behind your favorite series, films, documentaries, and specials. I'm your host, Krista Smith. For years, I was Vanity Fair's ambassador to Hollywood, interviewing countless actors as well as creatives and authorities across the spectrum. My passion is talent, any form of it. How do you know you have it? How do you cultivate it? How do you protect it? And also, I want to get to the heart of what drives it. On this podcast, I'll be talking to people in Hollywood and far beyond. Thank you for joining me. I'm speaking to an American icon today, Alan Alda. Now in his eighth decade, he pursues life with a kind of boundless curiosity and passion that can inspire us all. America first fell in love with Alda as Hawkeye Pierce in the legendary show MASH, which ran for 11 seasons and on which he also wrote and directed. Alda received a staggering 25 Emmy nominations, winning 5 times. For many, that scale of success could have been the whole story. But Alda's career continued. He's a 3-time Tony Award nominee, an Oscar nominee for his performance in Martin Scorsese's The Aviator, and he has 6 Golden Globes to his name. But beyond the stage and screen, Alda is a devoted husband and father. He's been equally busy with extensive work in charity, writing his memoirs, and devoting himself to the Alan Alda Center for Communicating Science. He also has his own podcast, Clear and Vivid, for which he's spoken to everyone from Yo-Yo Ma to a hostage negotiator for the FBI. In this conversation, we talk about his new film, Marriage Story, in which he delivers a superb performance as a divorce lawyer, his experience living and working with Parkinson's, and his advice for this generation. It's my privilege to bring you Alan Alda. Hello, everybody. I've got Alan Alda on Present Company today, an absolute privilege. You can't be alive and not have seen Alan Alda in something. It's incredible. You've been at it since you were 20 or even younger.
Younger. I was an understudy to the actor Don Murray when I was 19 on Broadway.
Wow.
But I was an apprentice when I was 16. I got paid $25 a week to be an apprentice, which is pretty good.
And that's better than some interns get paid now,
yeah.
Right?
And I not only made the scenery, they gave me leading parts to play, so I was getting great experience. But the guy I worked for, the producer of the Summer Stock Company, his theory of acting was a little different from what I later developed. His theory of acting was shout and duck.
And also, last year you started your own podcast, Clear and Vivid.
Clear and Vivid. I love my podcast. I have the best time. And I love it that other people love it. It makes me very happy. It's all about relating and communicating with other people. And I talk to people who you wouldn't expect to have really touching and interesting and valuable stories about relating and communicating. Our first show is with Sarah Silverman, who had this extraordinary experience where somebody tweeted to her a one-word insult, the worst thing you can call a woman. And instead of blocking him or going into a tirade, she looked up his profile and found out he was in pain with back pain. And she wrote him back and said, "My back hurts really badly, too. I know what it's like. why don't you try to speak from a place of love, though? And he wrote back and said, I can't, I have no love left in me. That was ripped out of me by a man who abused me when I was a child. Then she found a place where he could get therapy for free. He took the therapy, he changed his life, and now they communicate regularly as friends.
Wow.
And messages. Isn't that an amazing story?
Yeah, I have not heard that. That is an amazing story.
And I have story after story like that. I talk to famous people and people you might not have heard of, but they all have interesting stories. And, I mean, for instance, a guy called, his last name is Voss, and he used to be the chief hostage negotiator for the FBI, big international hostage cases. And he got the hostages released not by arguing with the people, but by stating for them what their problem was, what their complaint was. And he didn't agree with them, mm-hmm. didn't argue with them. It was just a question of letting them know that they were heard.
Mm-hmm.
And he tried this wonderful technique. He never wanted them to say, you're right. He wanted them to say, that's right. Because
mm-hmm.
that's right gave them the power to not only disagree, gave them the power to give up the hostage.
Right.
And he told me this amazing thing, that the techniques he used to get hostages released were very useful in a marriage.
Well, speaking of marriages, you've been married for, I don't know, 62 years?
62 years, yeah.
Oh, you've written about very successfully relationships and movies and couples. Four Seasons comes to mind.
Yeah, I've been thinking about this question for a long time, it seems. I didn't realize it.
Yeah.
And this movie is a perfect example.
Right, Marriage Story, right?
Marriage Story. Because in a marriage, which almost always starts because the two people are in love, they have to learn to communicate well and to relate to each other well for the marriage to last. And when that breaks down and leads to a divorce, they find this amazing other thing that they have to contend with, which is that they have to communicate even better in a divorce than they did in the marriage.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, they're going to have a divorce that shatters their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And what I love about this movie is that Noah Baumbach, who wrote the script and directed the movie and has a history of a number of really great movies. What he was able to do in this story was tell the story of a marriage that does go through a divorce and yet is a love story because they do finally learn to communicate and to relate to each other better.
Mm-hmm.
Even though they're divorced, they find other lives, but they have a child between them, and it's of the utmost importance for them to cooperate really well and not get in each other's way. So there's this ironic thing in the movie that even though, according to the old-fashioned Hollywood standards, it doesn't end with a happy ending, it does end with a satisfying ending for me,
mm-hmm.
because they make the adjustment to live in a difficult, uncertain world.
Now, how did Noah approach you? You're a New Yorker. You've lived on the East Coast your whole life, other than when you were doing MASH for 11 years and commuting back and forth.
Yeah.
But how did Noah approach you to be in the film? And you play one of Adam Driver's lawyers.
Right. I don't remember how I got approached. I'm sorry I can't answer that in the thrilling way.
Yeah.
All I remember is I read the script, I guess sent to me by my agent. And I loved it, and I wanted to be in it because it represented such good writing.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know I was getting a bonus along with that. The company of Noah Baumbach, who's such a wonderful director, a wonderful mm-hmm. person to work with, and these actors who were brilliant and fun to be with.
Yeah, I wanted to talk. You were with Adam Driver. Most of your scenes were with him, and he's one of the greats. He's on his way, I believe, into being one of the really, truly greats. He's still young.
Right,
but
right.
He's
I think
so...
he's certainly in his generation, mm-hmm. he's one of the best, if not the best. And he's going to be one of those memorable stars that we all take for granted, you know, Humphrey Bogart and people who are powerful screen presences. But he's an amazing actor wherever you put him, on the screen or on the stage. He was in the play Burn This on Broadway,
mm-hmm.
and I saw him in that the same week I saw him in Marriage Story. They're two polar opposites in terms of the characters he played. But he was so invested in the character in each case. As you watched it, you thought to yourself, well, of course, he's just playing himself. He's not he's not trying to be somebody else. But he can be somebody else without appearing to try.
Well, I know Noah likes to rehearse a lot. That's part of his process, right?
Yeah.
How was that rehearsing with Adam?
Well, it was you know, the pleasure of rehearsing with him and the pleasure of playing on camera with him was the same as the pleasure of sitting with him and getting to know him and becoming friends. He's so direct and so honest and without an agenda, and he's not trying to steal the scene and he's not trying to steal the conversation in person. It's really, he's a wonderful guy. And Scarlett gives such an amazing performance. I only had one or two scenes with her. But when I see what she was able to do, this was an extraordinary thing. Toward the end of the movie, when they've already made the adjustment to live apart, he comes back and he tells her something that he probably should have said a year ago. And she looks at him. There's no dialogue, but you can read her mind. I mean, I felt I knew exactly what she was thinking. That's a great performance.
I feel I talked to her a little bit about this, her two scenes where there's no dialogue, and that one you're referring to at the end of the movie is just, that affected me almost more than anything.
Yeah, it is very
devastating.
Yeah.
You know, maybe as a woman, I was relating more on the Scarlett side. I was identifying that way, but just that, oh, like that feeling in a relationship, which Noah did so well. Like there's certain things that you'll do anything for your child and maybe you won't do anything for your spouse. But the way he wove that all together was incredible.
I'm curious to know how you feel about it. I get the impression that most of the people in the audience are going to be rooting for both of them, even though the sides are clearly drawn, and they're drawn more and more pronouncedly as the divorce gets uglier, as the lawyers get more tenacious and ruthless. They're drawn into a fight that they didn't intend in the first place. And the lawyers are fighting sort of dirty on both sides. And yet I'm rooting for both of them to survive, to find something that they can, some way out of it that doesn't destroy them. And it doesn't destroy the kid.
Right. I feel that I would agree with you. I feel like that's pretty much the genius of the film, is that the way Noah equally balanced the characters. And you, as an audience member, you tend to go with who you're watching, right? And there's a beautiful fluidity between the two. And you're rooting for them, I think. At least I was by the end. It was just heartbreaking. But I'm an eternal optimist. So I keep thinking, you know, where are they now? What's going on with Charlie and Nicole?
I think they move on to other lives, but they maintain a relationship. It's a different kind of relationship. And I run into people all the time who have managed to do that. I think we're trained to think if you don't get back together, there's a failure. The success is in learning how to live with somebody, even at a distance. If you can't live up close, at least live at a distance, like, with civility.
Did you ever contemplate divorce in your six-decade marriage?
No, I'm sure my wife contemplated murder.
But that couldn't have been easy. I mean, I think about, there's so much sacrifice that goes into a relationship with an actor, and obviously for you as well, a writer, a director. You have all these other passions, science. You have a whole, you know, school named after you at Stony Brook. Like, you are filled with ideas and energy, and it seems like the compulsion to actually lean into all of them. And I imagine being in that for your wife or your kids, you made a lot of, they made some sacrifices and you made a lot of sacrifices. I mean, just even flying back and forth for 11 years, every weekend, I read somewhere that you flew back 3 times in 1 week while you're doing MASH.
I did, but I get a little too much credit for that because we were together in California for the summer months. And for about 4 months after that, I would fly back every weekend. Mm-hmm. But that only took place for 7 or 8 years because then the kids went to college. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't every week for 7 or 11. We were on the air for 11 years. Mm-hmm. But
still a long time.
Yeah, it is. And I had a permanent buzz on from jet lag.
Yeah. I would imagine. And even then, traveling was more of a big deal. Now it feels like you've got lounges, you know, it feels like it runs a lot better than it must have been running at that time.
Yeah, we didn't have any money in the beginning, and I was, cramped into mm-hmm. economy class where if I was lucky, I could stretch out on 2 seats. Mm-hmm. You know? But I didn't think of it as a sacrifice. And I don't get the impression Arlene thinks of her end of the work we do in our marriage is a sacrifice. It's what you do to make it work. Mm-hmm. And I do a lot of stuff. There are many things that interest me. And I'm able to do them because of her encouragement. Mm-hmm. And that's literally true. When I leave the house to go do something, to perform someplace or give a talk or have a difficult meeting, the last thing I hear as I go out the door is Arlene saying, "You're going to be great." And it, as many hundreds of times as I've heard it, it does give me confidence and makes me feel good. And I'd say the same thing to her when she has a professional life of her own. So she has things to do while I'm doing my stuff that matter a lot to both of us.
Mm-hmm. Was there any point in your success where you thought, okay, I've made it. Now I can, take my foot off the gas. Like, this is it. I've gotten awards, I have more money than I know what to do with, I've, reached a certain level, and now I can just sit back and bask in it.
What would I do? What would the basking involve? Basking sounds like a self-immolation. I'm really not interested in basking. Mm-hmm. I'm very curious, and there's a lot I want to know. A lot I want to learn, and I found a way to be helpful to other people. You talked about this, the Alda Center for Communicating Science at Stony Brook University. Mm-hmm. Well, this is our 10th anniversary. We've trained over 15,000 scientists and physicians to communicate better, mm-hmm. to explain their work, and as far as the researchers are concerned, so that they can. The public can understand it. Funders can understand it enough to fund it. The government can understand what they're being asked for money for. And physicians can talk to their patients in a way that helps the patients heal better. Mm-hmm. Because studies have shown that the physician speaks with empathy to a patient. The patient is more likely to take the doctor's advice, take the medication, mm-hmm. do the exercise, that kind of thing. So by helping them communicate better, I am making a contribution that I didn't know 50 years ago I had it in me to do. But it all came out of the work that began when I was 2 years old, watching my father from the wings acting and watching burlesque comics perform. I was really learning the art of relating. And now I'm in a movie about relating. Mm-hmm. I have a podcast about relating. Mm-hmm. And we teach relating to scientists and physicians. Mm-hmm. I had no idea it was all going to blossom into that.
I know. It does look like a deliberate arc, but it wasn't at all.
It was an improvisation. And improvising is the only acting technique I ever studied. And I only did that for about 6 months. But it was a pure kind of improvising. It wasn't comedy improvising. And that changes you as an actor, and it changes you as a person as well. And that's how I've run my life, like an improvisation. And if my life looks, as you say, like a deliberate arc, a lot of improvisations look like they're deliberate too. But it's because one thing really does lead to another in a meaningful way. if you swim with the flow.
Mm-hmm. And by improvisation, you're not talking about, obviously, the comedy of Groundlings or Second City or any of that. You're talking about really being present and listening.
Right. And you can, after you do this kind of improvising for a while, this was invented by Viola Spolin a long time ago, like about 80 years ago. And if you do it enough, you can improvise a whole play, a one-act play that has a theme and has insight and can also be funny. And it looks like somebody wrote it, but it's happening moment by moment.
Did you do any improvising with Noah and Adam during rehearsals?
No. I think Noah wants, and rightly so, he wants the air of improvisation. I think he wants the spontaneity of improvisation, and he gets it. But he wants the lines he's slaved over feverishly to be spoken. And you can do both if people are sensitive to one another and toss the ball back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
As far as I know, that's the only way you're going to get a spontaneous performance.
And your character is this great. I mean, you've been a well-seasoned lawyer with ups and downs.
Of a crappy office.
Office, to say the least. It's like, is it a house? And the secretary kind of sits, or the assistant sits out front because you're in a kitchen going back and forth. It's just this great motion. And I feel like throughout the film, Noah gets the most kind of athletic performances out of these actors because there's so much moving and talking and whatnot. But you're lying about to Adam. I think it's like, you remind me of me in my second divorce. But also, your Parkinson's is, you know, you've talked about this, and it's on full display in this character.
Well, sometimes I don't know when I'm shaking. So I saw myself in an interview. I came back from an interview today, and I said, Darlene, it's amazing. I must be getting better. I didn't shake at all. And I looked at the video, and I didn't realize I was shaking. But that, you know, as long as it doesn't interfere with the audience focus on the scene and the character, it's just an attribute. If I had a limp,
mm-hmm.
or if I were in a wheelchair, like Lionel Barrymore acted for 15 or 20 years in a wheelchair, and all his characters were wheelchair bound, and nobody thought twice about it.
Mm-hmm. Say,
right, he's acting from a chair, fine.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm playing a Ray Donovan psychiatrist on Ray Donovan. And when they realized I had Parkinson's, they said, do you mind if we write that into the script? Because his brother has Parkinson's, and it would be good to play scenes that involve both characters. So I thought about it for a while, and they said, okay, as long as you, yeah, fine. But then now I'm doing scenes where the character I'm playing has a worse tremor than I have, and I have to fake it. And Liev Schreiber, who plays Ray Donovan, said to me, because his brother is played by Eddie Marson, and he said, you know, I've been watching you. I think Eddie is better at it than you. He doesn't have Parkinson's.
That's funny. Well, obviously, through Michael J. Fox, who got it at early, at such a young age.
I know. He's really had a struggle with it.
Mm-hmm.
But he is so positive and has such a good sense of humor. He's writing a book about, at the time he was writing a book about a positive attitude.
Mm-hmm.
He was stuck, and he had a block, and he couldn't keep the process going. And he complained to his wife, "I'm never going to finish my book about positivity." But he was on the podcast, mm-hmm. on my podcast, Clear and Vivid, and it is really remarkable because he's such an admirable person and was able with me to trade stories, trade techniques. My condition is nowhere near his, and if I'm lucky, I can hold it off for a long time. But we still share tasks that we have to find a way to accomplish, like buttoning your shirt in less than 10 minutes,
right?
Tying your shoes, that kind of thing. And he's so good-natured about it. And he said this wonderful thing. He says, I don't think about that it took me 5 minutes to tie my shoes. I think about, I got my shoes tied.
Yeah.
You know? And that, I think that is positive.
Really positive. You've played a lot of senators in your career. A lot of politicians, I should say. A
couple of presidents.
Some better than others. And obviously, in the movie you wrote, The Seduction of Joe Tynan. I want to know, have you ever been tempted to get into politics at any point?
No, I was never tempted to get into politics. I mean, I never felt the temptation. I was tempted by other people. Once or twice, people from a political club in New Jersey came to the MASH set and said, we'd like you to run for senator, U.S. senator from New Jersey. I said, why would I do that? I'm an actor. I want to be an actor. I'm an artist. I'm not a politician. And anyway, I said, I don't know how to do it. I'm not a professional politician. I wouldn't know what to do. They said, yeah, but we could get you elected. So this is how this is who gets elected, I guess. People who sometimes don't know what they're doing. But I knew what I wanted out of life. It didn't seem to me to be an attractive idea, because I felt I could make a contribution, and I did want to make a contribution. I care a lot about our lives as a culture, as a nation, but I want to be really helpful. I don't want to be helpful. I don't want to do things that I think are helpful but aren't really. I want to test it out and see if it's really what's needed and if I can come up with it. And I just followed the path that I was on. And who knew I'd wind up helping in a much bigger way? I mean, we trained scientists in government agencies and eight other countries all across the United States. And it's very, that really is satisfying. I really think I'm making a contribution. And I still get to work in my chosen field as an actor and as a writer.
I want to talk a little bit about the writing, because it's so interesting to me that we know you mostly as an actor, first and foremost, right? You're so prolific. And yet you were writing the whole time. I mean, I looked at the MASH, the IMDb page of MASH, and you were basically credited as writing from season one. And then you went on to obviously write many, many more and direct. And obviously the final episode, which I think still stands as the most watched episode ever in the history of anything. stadiums were filled with people.
I was just in Toronto. Somebody told me he watched the final episode in a basketball stadium with 20,000 people. Is that amazing?
Yeah, and I'm not surprised.
I'd never heard that before.
I think that people don't realize how huge that show was. And also, I'm not surprised they wanted you to run for senator, because Hawkeye Pierce, you was the most popular character. Your fame was huge at that time.
Well, it was a shock when I got so well known so quickly. I didn't know how to handle it. And I had seen my father become famous, and he was a very well known movie star in the 40s. And people's reaction, maybe more so then than now, because now they grab a picture of you sometimes without asking. But then they wouldn't only ask for an autograph. One time we were on Hollywood Boulevard and a kid ran up and punched him in the back. And none of us understood it. But it was the discomfort that some people feel in the presence of a famous person. People get disoriented. Mm-hmm. We all do. We all have somebody who makes us go a little gaga. Mm-hmm. It's more a scientist with me than a movie star or a great musician. But one time when I met Lee Vollman in the parking lot of a Chinese restaurant, I was so taken with her because she had been my heartthrob for years, you know, on the screen. Mm-hmm. I couldn't even hear what she was saying. I was completely disoriented. And then little by little, I began to realize I was talking to an actual person.
What were some of the pitfalls that you made when you became famous? I mean, did you have any missteps, anything that you learned from about dealing with that kind of success and attention?
I had to learn that they were not talking about me. they were talking about a comic book character that represented me. There was an avatar called Alan Alda, and he didn't live the life I led. He didn't have the vulnerabilities that I had or the sensibilities. It was who they thought I was. I became a stereotype, became Mr. Nice Guy. Mm-hmm. Because I was so active as a feminist and working so hard to try to get the Equal Rights Amendment passed, which would have put women in the Constitution for the first time, I actually got the stereotype of being a wimp. Because if you're a man and you don't represent the aggressive male stereotype, then you must be a wimp. Mm-hmm. That idea, I think, has changed to a great extent now. Mm-hmm. Do you get that impression?
Yeah, I do. Oh, for sure. But I think
You see men carrying babies and pushing baby.
Well, I think the success of, what was that movie, Three Men and a Baby? It was like such a shock, men taking care of babies. Now I think that, we've definitely evolved.
So we didn't get the Equal Rights Amendment passed, but the culture did develop a different way of thinking, I think.
Mm-hmm. So for you as an artist, do you enjoy the writing and the directing and the acting with equal measure?
Yeah, but I'm glad I don't try to do all three at once at the same time anymore. Mm-hmm. I think it diminished a little bit of what I could contribute in each of the areas. But when you write something, it goes on film, you kind of do want to direct it if you know how and if they'll let you. Because it might have been, I forget who, Orson Welles might have been the one who said, there are three movies, the one you write, the one you shoot, and the one you edit. And when you write it, you don't know how those other two are going to affect it. And when you shoot it, you don't know how the editing is going to affect it, even though you might be cutting it in your head. And Noah is very astute at that.
What was it like being directed by him? I mean, are there any signature traits that he has that are clearly identifiable as like, oh, that is a Noah that I'm working with Noah Baumbach?
He has utter respect for the other person. You don't see him calculating how to phrase it to make you do something you're not interested in doing or wouldn't be helpful to you. He doesn't say unhelpful things. He, in a way, he gives you the impression he's discovering it with you. And that's exciting. And if you come up with something that seems to go in a direction he didn't expect, he encourages that and helps you try other ideas that are maybe more in line with what he envisioned when he wrote it. And that takes a lot of tries, so he has a reputation for doing a lot of takes. But I'm from the stage, and I like long runs because the more I do it, the better I get. Mm-hmm. So I was disappointed when I heard he did 20 takes because I thought that we needed more.
Well, Adam, when I talked to Adam, he had said that, they really indulge their bad habits. Like they could do 50 takes of one thing and be like, do we get it? Are you sure we've got it? Should we do one more?
if you have the time, why not? Mm-hmm. You don't want to go over schedule and over budget just playing games. But if you smell that you're after something that might be really unusual and good, then you should go for it.
Mm-hmm. Are there any actors or directors that you would love to work with again? You've worked with so many talented people.
I know, and they each have their own signature, as you pointed out. I'd love to work with Noah some more. I'd love to work more with Scorsese. And look at the people I've worked with.
I know. Scorsese, you got that was Aviator, and you got an Oscar nomination for that
wasn't
performance.
That nice?
Another senator.
Yeah, right. Well, I play people who wear suits because I don't look so good in a loincloth.
How is it to be directed by him and to be on his sets?
It's wonderful. He's very positive, very encouraging. After a take, he'll come over and say, "That was great. I loved that. Just terrific the way you did that. That thing. You might go a little bit more in this other direction, but only if you feel like it. Just try it. Give it a little try. So, let's go again." And by the time he walks away, you realize he hated what you did, but you feel so good about it.
that you're ready to do it again and again.
Oh, sure, sure. Yeah. It's a pleasure to be with him. He's a very warm person. He's very nice. Mm-hmm. And Spielberg was wonderful. And he knows so much about filmmaking. And both of them, both he and Marty Scorsese, they both are walking encyclopedias of film. And they love to talk about film. So it's really fun. You're not only having the fun of acting in one of their movies, you're getting a course in film history.
Mm-hmm.
It's great.
Yeah, I love, like yourself, they're so prolific well into their careers. You know, no one, it's almost like, I feel like with Scorsese, and actually with Spielberg too, they're more energized the older they get almost.
Well, it's great when you take somebody like either one of them who is a fountain of talent and has so much experience. The experience combined with a talent and ability, and I think talent and ability are two different things. Talent is what you come in with. Ability is what you make of it. And the experience of doing that over and over again has to deepen your understanding of how to do it. So when they're in their 90s, if they're still making movies, they're going to make profoundly interesting movies because they'll have the tools that they don't have now and that nobody else will have at that point.
Mm-hmm.
I think we still undervalue age. It's important to have the recklessness of youth and the innovation, the love of innovation, the drive toward innovation that youth has. But I think we've evolved to have grannies for a reason, because that's where the wisdom and the foot on the brakes comes in sometimes. And everybody has a different talent, you know? Mm-hmm. Everybody has a different way to fill their role in the culture. It's very interesting to me, because when I was young, I considered myself an activist, and I wouldn't apply that term to myself now, but it seemed to me important to work overtly on the problems, to be part of the fight. I think I'm less interested in the fight now than I am in resolving fights, resolving tensions between people. We're in a terrible state of falling apart as a culture. We don't trust one another.
Do you think it's worse than it's ever been? I know, and I ask a lot of older people that have lived through, you know, the 60s and the 70s and all these kind of politically divisive times in American culture. Do you feel now that in 2019 we're worse than it was in 1968?
It's hard to judge. I did live through the last time I can remember when things were about as bad as this, what was during the Vietnam War. But there were some ways that was worse, and there were some ways this was worse. This is worse. When those students were shot by the National Guard,
mm-hmm.
that was frightening because we had never had anything like that, at least not in memory. And there probably were fights at the Thanksgiving table, but I don't know if families came apart the way they come apart now. So there are aspects in both areas that are both times that are very hard to live with. But I hope we can come out of this and get to be friends and love each other again.
I do think that's one of the most powerful things about art. And it's not lost on me that you're in the communicating through and having scientists and communication, because actors are the best communicators. And it's whether it's obvious or subliminal, or even the messages that you guys were working on when you were shooting MASH about, takes place during the Korean War. There's all kinds of conversations and controversies that can kind of get worked out through a series or worked out through film. And even in Marriage Story, you see this. I mean, it's ironic that you're playing the lawyer that's been divorced four times, but yet somehow you're the reason. You're the most reasonable voice for a large portion of the film.
Not that that helps.
Yeah, not that it helps. Exactly. Ego gets the best of everybody.
Yeah, that's one of the things about the movie that could make you lose hope. But they, in spite of that, they find a way to adjust to what's happened to them. And to, it often boils down to me to empathy, to being willing to just have some understanding of what the other person is going through. You can't know for sure. But when you said that actors, you said something like this a minute ago, that actors make a contribution to the society. For me, the way we do it is that we give the audience a chance to empathize with people they might not otherwise even have come across. Even if it's bad guys or people who are suffering because they find themselves in an untenable situation, to feel for them, to feel with them, not necessarily to agree with them. Empathy doesn't mean you agree with them or you want them to do well or you have compassion for them. It just means that you, the way I look at it, it just means that you understand their point of view. You understand what made them, in a way, what they are. If you understand that, you have an opportunity to work with them.
What advice would you have for this generation coming up in this kind of political environment and toxicity and polarization? I mean, what would you say to young people listening?
I really think I found that if you listen to the other person, let the other person know that you are listening, and you don't have to indicate that you agree, but you just have to let them know they're being heard, there's a greater chance. There's some chance, maybe it's even a small chance, that they'll listen to you. The tone, the choice of words, the very attitude you have, if it's not deeply and truly respectful, they're going to sense it and they're going to resist you. Mm-hmm. And maybe you'll find that there's something in what they're saying, some little thing that really is valuable. I have this radical way of talking to people, where I feel I'm not really listening unless I'm willing to be changed by them in some way. Just willing to be. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean I always am.
Have you evolved into this person that you are right now in front of me? Or is this something that you had from a very young age, from your kind of unconventional upbringing with vaudeville and having that theater family?
I grew into this. I was thinking this morning about some of the every once in a while it comes back to me how I've done quite the opposite of what I was just saying with somebody. Mm-hmm. And I think, boy, what was going on in my head? Why did I need to be superior to that person? Because it didn't work. I mean, the reason I remember it is because the person's reaction was really not good.
Mm-hmm. I would imagine that, especially working in Hollywood and in movies and television, there's always a lot of personalities and a lot of opinions and a lot of complicated individuals.
So how do you handle somebody? This is one of the seven questions I ask at the end of my show.
All right.
How do you handle somebody? How do you tell somebody they have their facts wrong?
Well, it's interesting because I agree with you. You have to listen to what they're saying, and then you have to basically present that, well, I found this was the case and that was the case, which is, you know, you present your side to it. But a lot of times I find, and I used to joke about this, certainly in my time at Vanity Fair and in life, there was that line in Seabiscuit, the movie about the book was first a book, obviously. Laura Hildebrand wrote that great book about the horse Seabiscuit and War Admiral and whatnot. It became a movie. And I remember this line about how Seabiscuit was this thoroughbred, very high strung, and they had to bring in Pumpkin, this other kind of workhorse, to settle Seabiscuit down. So I often feel like I'm playing the role of Pumpkin. I'm settling down. You know, I come in and I'm like absorb all the information and absorb everyone's like kind of feeling and then process it and try to come up with some kind of solution to either get on with the day or figure out what needs to get accomplished and why we all came there to begin with.
That sounds nice. I never heard the answer to that question. We've done about 70 interviews. I never heard anybody say they, well, the way I handle it is I'm pumpkin.
I'm pumpkin. You know, it's true. It's the clearest way I could answer that question.
That's good.
Well, thank you. And I have to say that spending this time with Alan Alda right in front of me has been amazing. What you've done with your life, not even career, just life, is so inspirational to me. And the fact that you're able to excel in all these different areas, I have great admiration for you. And I'm
really happy that I got to
sit with you. And on another note, you're great in the movie. You're fabulous in Marriage Story.
I love the movie. I'm so proud to be in it. Makes me very happy. Mm-hmm. And I really have enjoyed talking with you. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
And I don't disagree with anything you said about me as a person.
Well, that's good. Thanks so much for joining me. Marriage Story is in theaters and streaming now on Netflix. Please subscribe, rate, and review this podcast wherever you've been listening. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Krista Smith. Join me next time for more meaningful conversations here at Present Company.